Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had an incredibly wide-ranging conversation with Sam Kaplan. Sam is a partner at Five Seasons, a pan-European venture capital fund investing in iconic and sustainable consumer brands with over 300 million euros in assets under management. Sam has been immersed in consumer his whole career, starting as an analyst at Citi, then moving on to join and build Chris Birch's family office, now Birch Creative Capital, after his successful exit from fashion label Tory Birch, where Sam managed investments from as low as 25,000 all the way to writing checks for 25 million. Sam joined Five Seasons after launching and ultimately exiting a startup to assist football clubs better serve and build value from their fan base. In today's episode, we talk about investing 25,000 to 25 million at Birch Creative Capital, how over curation leads to the homogenous nature of venture, how in early stage consumer, especially, the first thing is to understand if you have an emotional reaction to a brand, how customer acquisition costs equal brand, whilst retention equals product, and that there is no switching cost in consumer, so LTV doesn't make sense.
Past customer behavior is not an indicator of future.
CAC payback in consumer is critical, and that the holy grail is to be first purchase profitable.
That is possible in certain categories. It's less possible in, you know, other lower margin categories.
How consumer produces fewer unicorns than tech, which means you need to understand portfolio construction deeply. No one in your portfolio can go to zero. And how VCs don't make business win, founders make or break a business.
If I'm doing my job, maybe I can help them get places a little bit quicker. Maybe I can help them not make common mistakes because I have the benefit of seeing a portfolio of 20 companies.
How stopping consuming VC media made Sam a better consumer investor. And his contrarian opinion?
I think that the US that we grew up with is gone.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, thank you for joining me. I thought I would just take a moment to reintroduce myself, given that I've got you here. My name's Arish, and I am the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from C to Series B and beyond. I really hope you enjoy the podcast, and if you do, do join the tens of thousands of subscribers and listeners across all our platforms, whether it's YouTube, Spotify, or Apple. We would love for you to join us. And if there's something that you particularly want to get in touch with me about, do connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter, now X, and have a conversation. I'm always up for it. Right, let's get straight back into it. Sam, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to be here.
Okay. Look, before we get some of the more meaty questions, because we definitely have some meaty questions, it would be remiss of me not to mention that you spent 6 years building out the kind of venture offering of what would ultimately become Birch Creative Capital, which is essentially the family office side of Christopher Birch, who co-founded and then exited his position in the fashion label Tony Birch with his now ex, Tory Birch with his now ex-wife. You were writing checks from sort of 25K all the way to 25 million. This must have been an absolutely wild time because you were just out of investment banking, right? I think. So what was your kind of biggest learning from that period? I'd love to understand.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was absolutely a wild time. And I think I was incredibly lucky to have been kind of by Chris's side for as long as I was. And I think, you know, the biggest learning from that was really take every conversation. I think what makes Chris particularly unique is... I think typically, especially as people get kind of wealthier, more powerful, et cetera, the standard to get in their office door gets higher. And Chris isn't like that at all. It's full open door policy. And it was very much a day coming to work where you never knew who was going to come in that door. And one day it might be, you know, Titan of industry. And the next day it might be... you know, someone who's a bellboy at a hotel that Chris stayed in who had an opportunity they wanted to pitch him. And I've tried to take that with me kind of continuously in my career because I very much saw how that kept Chris, you know, largely at the top of his game.
And just he saw everything.
He saw everything, just continuously learning.
I mean, it's amazing just on that point. I remember like when I used to work out in Papua New Guinea, we always used to say like, never, you know, judge a customer. And like in Papua New Guinea, you could have all sorts of customers coming in, but the guy with like a ripped shirt and flip-flops coming through the door could like drop 30,000 on your table and buy a bunch of furniture because they're buying it for like their whole community or whatever.
Yeah.
And equally, I think this whole kind of gatekeeping aspect of venture, which a lot of founders obviously complain about, like I get to some extent because there is some curation that you want to go through. But the flip side of that is obviously if you over curate, venture is a game of outliers. If you overcreate, you are potentially missing out on those outliers. And, you know, the bellboy from the hotel might well be one of those outliers. You just don't know what their story is, right?
Yeah, completely. And I think that over-curation also leads to the homogenous nature of, you know, we've all seen and we all see the metrics around who gets funded.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you over-curate, really what that means and equates to is your life just becomes an echo chamber.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes the outliers, as you said, don't come from, you know, that echo chamber.
Yeah. I mean, it's the whole, you know, if you only invest in Harvard male 40-year-old white dudes, for example, then you're going to see many of the same sort of businesses being created. Whereas, like, and I think the, you know, the data is out there that, like, you know, 60% of ventures are migrant led, right?
Yeah.
Or you tend to see the data seems to support that female led businesses tend to outperform, right? But again, do you see enough of those, right? Like that, are they truly the outliers, or actually, if you over-indexed, or if you at least not over-indexed, but if you at least balance that kind of portfolio, would you have an equal index? Like, would you see the same data arise? I don't know, but like, we need to get there.
We need to get there to actually test.
But no, I think that's incredible. And look, I mean, I think that family offices in particular can be really exciting places. Because you are in command of what you invest in. It's your own capital. Well, I mean, in this case, obviously, Christopher's capital, but, you know, he can make the decision day to day whether he's going to write the check or not. Whereas obviously, you know, if you're an venture or if you're an institutional investor, like you have constraints, right?
Yeah.
Either LP constraints or, you know, your LPs have invested in your fund essentially based on the thesis that you've presented. That in itself is constricting, right? Or constraining and a constraining factor in terms of what you can invest in. So yeah, no, look, I think I would have loved to have done something like that, although maybe not in the sort of creative stroke consumer space, because as we just talked about, I'm not particularly good at taking those sort of bets. So as I was saying, I am not the best judge of consumer businesses. And I think so much of it comes down, especially at early stage, to the interplay between brand and product, which, you know, unlike B2B SaaS or software, it's much more driven by an emotional reaction or personal preferences, right? So if I think about, you know, Harry's shaving or you know, even Innocent Drinks and their exit to Coke, you know, like I wouldn't have been able to take the bet that these are the brands that are going to succeed. So how do you think about that dynamic and what sorts of metrics or indicators do you use to kind of weigh and value whether a consumer business is going to be able to create a breakthrough brand?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost, what you said is exactly right, which is on an early stage consumer brand or consumer in general, the first and most important thing is, do you have an emotional reaction to it? And I think that a lot of investors or people generally have tried to quantify brand.
Yeah.
And we've yet, you know, we've yet to fully do so. And, you know, my belief is that I hope that I or we as a firm, you know, bring a differentiated point of view when it comes to brand of, do I see the magic in this? Now, if I do, the next step is, okay, do the numbers back that up? Mm. And the really crude way that I think about that at first blush is that customer acquisition cost equals brand and retention equals product.
Yeah.
But if those two metrics are amazing, but I look at it and I just feel blah, that's an almost insurmountable moat for me to cross to get to investment.
So if you don't feel that kind of like visceral, yeah, I love this, it doesn't pass a smell test.
For sure. And you have to challenge yourself, right? Because at the same time, loving something doesn't have to mean I love it.
Yeah.
Right?
Can it be loved?
Right.
Yeah. Because like, for example, you're not going to fall in love with, for example, period pant.
Yeah, exactly.
Pants, right? Like that, like.
So. Exactly. But I can fall in love with, there's a Berlin-based maker of period panties called The Female Company.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I am in love with the brand work that The Female Company have done. And I think when you hit their landing page, it's quite clear that you're dealing with a differentiated asset, an animal to several of the others that are in the market.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think about a lot and have been thinking about a lot over the last several years is actually all businesses are brand businesses. Like, I mean, I don't think any bit, whether it's software or not, right? Whether it's a consumer brand or not, whether it's software, whether it's a consultancy business like mine, like brand is essential, because if you can't create that emotional connection, either as an individual or a business with your target market, right? Then you don't have a business, right? Yeah. You are just yelling into kind of the ether. And especially in a world which is hyper competitive, right? Like ultimately you could have the best, I don't know, canned drink. We saw, right? What was it? Not Wicked. What was the, you know, there's one water in a can business that absolutely blew up. Devil, I can't.
Oh, like, oh, Liquid Death.
Liquid Death. That's the one, right?
Liquid Death.
That clearly created like a massive, massive brand, you know, like it created a brand, but it had massive traction because people kind of bought into that. It's still water in a can, right? Yeah. Like, so actually, you know, sometimes your product can be amazing, but if your brand is not there, irrespective of what your product is, whether consumer or not, if you don't have the brand, you're just not going to sell.
Yeah. I mean, and even I would take that one step further and say that oftentimes brand can even beget product.
Yeah, sure.
I hate Slack as a product. I do. I still don't understand its value. And yet obviously it's a multi-billion dollar asset. And what I can say is that if Slack was called, you know, short form inter-office email replacer, yeah, right? I don't think it's... Yeah. On every desktop of every office everywhere.
WhatsApp is like is the other one, right? Like billions of users, like built by some dudes in India. And I actually, in my business, we use WhatsApp more than we use Slack.
Yeah.
Right? Like internally with our teams, et cetera. Right? And I think, but just think about the nature of that brand, like WhatsApp. I don't talk about texting people. I talk about WhatsApp.
Absolutely.
And it has become, you know, it's become a verb and you know, in much the same way that, you know, Hoover is, you know, that's how we talk about vacuuming, right?
Exactly.
But I think that's, I think that's really, really true, you know, but, and with Slack, this is a good example, right? Has the brand outgrown the product, if you see what I mean, right? To your point, like if we use it, but we don't use it a huge amount anymore in my business. A lot of our clients use it, obviously, as an an internal company communications tool. But where I've seen it used a lot in businesses, often it gets overused, and actually the product the value decays completely with usage because it becomes overused. And of course, they then ran up to the fact that, okay, brand is good, product is okay, but distribution,
right?
When you have Microsoft saying, that's okay, we're just going to bundle Teams into everything, you're done.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think I maybe need to do a bit more work on my ability to understand brands. Because I'm also someone, by the way, that like, so I just switched the iPhone literally a week and a half ago. Like really didn't want to, really resisted it. I thought it was overplayed, certainly since day one. I was an Android user, liked the ability to configure. I really like it. And I kind of now get the brand, you know, the sort of visceral sort of feeling that people have for the Apple brand and Apple products. because it just, everything works seamlessly.
Yeah.
But I would not consider myself, and this is the point, right? Like, I wouldn't consider myself someone that buys something because of the brand, but I now understand why other people bought
do
that
or would, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And Liquid Death, just because you mentioned
sure.
it, water and alcohol are the best just brand indicators
yeah.
because it's a commodity product.
Yeah.
Like, there've been how many, just a zillion tests that say if you put like 7 tequilas in front of someone, they have no idea which is which. But when they walk into a bar, they order with like such,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, I want whoever, yeah. know, whatever. Yeah,
and, and water obviously is even more so that. It's yeah. like, it's literally water. And yet if you put, if people walk up in a store and you have a fridge in front of them with a bunch of different waters, everyone has a really strong opinion about which one they like.
Yeah.
And they'll start telling you it tastes different
yeah.
and X, Y, and Z. I'll tell you who doesn't think they taste different. The advertising agencies that are building the brands for those waters, right?
Yeah.
And so what Liquid Death has done and did is so incredible. And, you know, Essentia before that and Fiji before that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. I'd forgotten about Fiji.
Yeah. yeah, and another one in the future.
Perrier and Evian before them, yeah.
Yeah, and I think anyone who ever tries to say to me, like, look, brand, strip it all back, brand doesn't matter.
It clearly does, right? Yeah. I mean, we thought a lot about it when we decided to rebrand Nothing Venture as well. We're like, okay, we need to get a bit of bit of differentiation going. But no, look, I mean, I think what's really important is, and what I think it all comes down to is trust, right? Like, ultimately, if you trust the brand you're buying from, you're more likely to buy their product. And I think, you know, if the brand conveys and builds trust with its consumers, it has much more chance of success, irrespective of any defects in the product. But defects in the product will ultimately lead to churning customers or less retention. So
for sure,
you've got to kind of strike the balance between making sure that whilst your brand is serving the purposes it should be, your product has to be able to meet it, right? And I think there have been examples, I can't think of them off the top of my head, where, you know, again, a little bit like what we said about Slack, where the brand, you know, where the product didn't do a disservice to the brand ultimately, yeah. right? Like, and I think you see that with new product launches often, right? Where the product sort of falls short. But moving slightly on, as a finance guy, I really had to go through this with you because I couldn't really agree more. You and I had talked about the fact that LTV doesn't really apply to most consumer businesses. And I get really frustrated when investors ask me for LTV metrics on a consumer business. I'm like, that isn't the way buying patterns work. But, you know, I have been in a lot of startups where I'm asked for this. So what do you think are the critical success metrics in consumer, and why should founders be laser focused on, or what should they be laser focused on when they're thinking about the sort of metrics that point to successful scale?
Sure. And I want to touch on LTV quickly just before we blow past it, which is to say the issue with LTV for consumer is that there is no switching cost.
Mm.
And so LTV is a long-term metric that typically people are using to say, my customer lifetime value is X, and therefore I can spend up to X on new customer acquisition. The problem is that because there is no switching cost in consumer, past customer behavior is
not an indicator of future.
It's not an indicator of future. And so just for switching costs, you know, to very quickly cover it, if I buy pants from brand X, and I have for the last 3 years, and then I wake up one day and I say, no, I want to start buying pants from brand Y. Has that negatively affected my life in any way? No.
And will you go back to buy brand X? Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. If, you know, we use Affinity as our CRM at Five Seasons, as I'm sure, you know,
many VCs do.
Many, many VCs do. If we had to switch from Affinity tomorrow, it'd be catastrophic.
Painful.
Yeah. Painful, catastrophic. All of our customer data, company data, network.
Yeah.
I mean, you name it. We keep a lot of internal just materials there generally. That's switching costs. That's pain.
Yeah.
That's why LTV works for B2B SaaS businesses. Yeah. but not for kind of consumer.
Yeah.
A variation of LTV that is much better for consumer is annual recurring revenue, ARR.
Yeah.
And that works for consumer or can be a helpful short-term metric for consumer if you're in a subscription-heavy category.
Yeah.
Of which there are some, much less so than maybe all of the subscription D2C businesses out there would have you believe. But if you take, say, pet food, which is a category we've invested in extensively, ARR in pet food is very real.
Yeah.
It's a very subscription friendly and heavy category.
Because you need it every month you're feeding your pet, like presumably.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, basically, people don't churn on pet food unless the product is really bad or sadly when their pet passes away. That's effectively what you have there. So ARR can be helpful as a short-term metric to say, what is the health of the business? Is my subscriber base growing? And if my subscriber base hits stasis, okay, what do I think the next 6 to 12 months will look like revenue-wise?
Sorry to interrupt, but like so that makes sense to me, right? But let's talk about a more traditional consumer product, or maybe less traditional, but let's say something like paint. You mentioned coat paints, for example, right? Like if that's a consumer product, and like I'm painting my house today, I'm not painting my house every day or even every year, right? Like, so how does that work?
Yeah, so this is, you pushed me exactly where I was going to go.
Sorry.
Which is...
I got ahead of myself,
Which is, at the end of the day, like, the unit economic that's most important is when's your customer break-even point.
Yeah.
And
so it's CAC payback, essentially.
Yes.
Right.
And ultimately, as a consumer brand, that needs to be as close to first purchase as possible because of exactly what you said. Will I go back to, the first pants brand? Who can say? Mm. Will I go back after I've bought the pants once? Who can say? Mm. And so ultimately, the holy grail in consumer is to be first purchase profitable.
Yeah.
That is possible in certain categories. It's less possible in, other lower margin categories. But if you are living in the other lower margin categories, hopefully those are categories that should have significantly higher repeat than, say, pants. Mm. But if you come to me and you're a footwear brand, you better be first purchase profitable.
Yeah.
And frankly, 95% of the decks that I see, the businesses I see are not.
So like digging into that for a second, right? So, because this was always my problem with consumer, and I guess you've answered the question for me, right? Which was, consumer to me felt like scale, like the only moat was capital. Like, essentially, you are throwing dollars into acquiring customers to scale revenue and or volume. But that's not sustainable because at a certain point, you can't just keep throwing dollars at it or can't keep, raising money to throw it. And of course, we saw that like in zero interest rate. That was actually a strategy that worked because it was like cost of capital cheap, screw it, let's just keep throwing money at this, right? Now we're in a place where capital is not cheap anymore and you can't just acquire customers, right? So when I think about a consumer or a brand play, like again, what I'm thinking about is what is word of mouth stroke sort of network effect if network effects exist, which I guess really with consumer products
whole less separate so. Conversation
whole separate conversation, but like it's a different style of network effect, but it has to be word of mouth and virality, right? Which helped to zero cost acquisition essentially, right? And then it's retention and it's, to your point, CAC payback and all of these sort of things. So I guess maybe the question I'm asking is like, is that identified? Like, can you at early stage see that a business is going to be on a trajectory to get there? Like, because presumably at the early stage, you're not going to see many that are first purchase profitable.
Sure.
But you want to see that they're that it's likely they can get there. What are the leading indicators to show that? Is that a declining CAC payback period over time, or is there some sort of magic inflection point maybe that?
Yeah, it certainly can be declining CAC payback period over time. The truth is that by the time I invest, which is kind of Series A and beyond, if a business isn't pretty close to first purchase profitable, they're never going to be.
Got it.
Of course, there are going to be exceptions to that, but in general, that's how I look at things. Forever, and this has stopped being so common, but forever, the kind of party line of every company was, we're not first purchase profitable today, but by the time our volume hits X,
we will be.
Because, economies of scale and cheaper product costs.
Yeah. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. We now know that there's virtually no examples of product volumes driving gross margin up faster than CAC goes up.
Yeah.
So,
because that's interesting, right? Because a lot of founders, they assume as they grow, CAC is going to reduce and decline because, okay, there's, more repeat purchase or there's virality again, word of mouth, et cetera. But I always say actually your CAC increases, right? Because you've acquired the cheap ones. You've now got to start acquiring the people that are harder to acquire because there's switching costs or not switching costs, but there's brand switching.
Yeah.
Switching costs that may come into play. But equally, and this is the other problem with the zero interest market or where we are now, which is you are all competing for the same share of wallet, right? Like everyone is bidding for limited cash, right?
Totally.
Like limited spend. So I guess it kind of follows that traditional S curve, right? Like, so it kind of increases, declines, and then increases and plateaus again. But yeah, so how do you see that working?
Yeah, well, so apologies to every customer out there, but there's not a single business I've ever invested in that I didn't post-investment immediately say, raise your prices.
Yeah.
Because any incremental, cent of margin that can be grabbed should be. Mm. And it gives you that just extra little bit of cushion of CAC going up a little bit.
And by the way, that goes for any business, not just because you put up your prices today.
Yeah. And of course, there's always a breaking point, something that's selling for, 10 pounds. You can't change the price to 90 pounds and not see, a catastrophic impact, but you probably can get it to 10.50 without seeing much of a decline. And so on this note and on this piece around where CAC's going and how do we ride that wave, we think that there are three different ways for a company to grow. Mm. And typically within grow also means diversifying away from channels that are becoming less ideal route of growth. And so in a very maybe management consulty way, we think about new product development, new distribution channels, and new geographies. Mm. As CAC starts to become untenable in, let's say, UK D2C, your options are, yes, implement a bunch of different bells and whistles, A/B testing. We have a whole laundry list of them we go through with our portcos. That can help some. Mm. But oftentimes what actually helps the most is, now let's list in Tesco. Mm. Now let's open up the Netherlands.
Yep.
Now let's release a lower price item or a trial pack that nudges, people in the door. It's very rarely keep as is status quo and this is going to take care of itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have scars. I think is actually the point here. And look, I couldn't agree more. I think you know, sometimes diversification, either a product or channel or geography or whatever it is the right answer. I think a lot of founders shy away from it because, well, and actually in fairness, like we often would advise founders to like be careful, because I think there is a point at which it's too early to go into that diversification, right? Like it is a fairly sort of delicate sort of balance between launching in a new geography or through a new channel or whatever when you're not prepared, right? Versus when you actually should be doing it and should be prepared for it. And I think a lot of founders potentially, you know, launch too early into a Tesco's or whatever and actually find that they're not able to service, right? Yeah. Because actually you've got to hold stock, which means there's working capital to be managed, which means XYZ, right? Like it's a different game and therefore you need to really, really be prepared for it. Now, you know, you can work your way through that, but a Tesco doesn't want to be out of stock, right? Like they don't want to see that sort of an issue hitting their shelves.
And it needs to be supported internally and externally.
Yeah.
Like internally, as you said, new working capital cycles, that's usually the big one.
Yeah.
But just separate team,
yeah.
Different skill set.
Yeah.
Most of the founders of, you know, new brands today are usually online, you know, online literate, passionate about the product, maybe passionate about the problem that they're trying to solve. They're very rarely, you know, ex-Reckitt CPG, yeah. like wholesale, yeah. you know, person.
Yeah.
And so you probably need someone like that.
Yeah.
You know, under the hood. And then externally, it's supporting with trade spend and marketing in store, yeah. because you're not going to turn on shelf if you don't do that, no matter how amazing your product is.
Yeah. Unless it is yeah. a brand that is already sort of out there in the, but if you're like a relatively new entrant and you're still kind of growing your brand presence, then yeah, like, I mean, you know, if you're a taco, if you're a taco product, you're not going to suddenly take market share from Old El Paso just because you happen to be on the supermarket shelf next to them, right?
Absolutely. And I think just on your point, because it was a good one around diversifying too soon, something that we think about a lot is just how big can a business get in its home geography, home channel. And that to us is a big kind of hoop to get through on our funnel, making its way down to, is this a business that we will ultimately give a term sheet to?
Because also there's no guarantee that you will see the same scale in other geographies, right?
Like that's certainly not.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Five Seasons as a firm has done 24 investments since 2018 when we were founded. 12 of those are in Germany. There's a reason for that,
okay.
right? It's because Germany is the only geography in Europe where you can build a several hundred million euro turnover brand without ever leaving.
Big enough consumer population that you can scale there without having to.
And yeah. eight of those 24 deals are here in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Similar reason. So that to us is, you know, again, not to sound too much like a management consultant, but our two founders both were. So that's probably why we, you know, sometimes look at things like this. You know, TAM is really
important. Yeah.
And there are a lot of brands, especially me, as someone who's just obsessed with brand generally, like there are a lot of brands that I love as a consumer and I would, you know, die to basically spend time with the founder and have an excuse to, but realistically I can't write a venture check
yeah.
into.
Yeah. And actually just whilst you were saying that, because like you said, TAM is really important, right? So then how do you think about like luxury brands, right? Where, and again, thinking about TAM in dollars as well as in terms of numbers, and also like, you know, just the thought process around like creating a luxury brand is one step beyond creating a great brand, because like it's one thing to create Harry's, it's another thing to create Ferrari, right? Yeah. Like, so when you look like, because clearly luxury brands can be incredibly profitable in large scale, but like, do you think about that? Like, do you think about, okay, well, this has a potential to become a luxury brand, even though actually the consumer volume for this out of like a population of 60 million is maybe 10,000 people. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we invest in premium brands.
Irrespective.
What does that mean, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it basically means they typically are priced at a premium to certainly mass players on the shelves. They're probably more modern, better for you, a bit sexier, et cetera, et cetera.
Less commoditized.
Less commoditized. Right. That can mean a comparatively luxury brand in a particularly boring or kind of non-created space. For example, we were an investor in a business called Y Food, which for the UK listeners, it's basically the Huel of Germany, meal replacement. You know, that's a premium product. I don't think anyone would say it's a luxury food item.
Got it, yeah.
But it's a premium product. True luxury, which I would say is kind of next stage up, realistically, it's they're just not venture, they're not venture backable companies. They're family office backable companies.
Right, yeah.
And I did a lot of it during my time at Birch. Mm. But if I invested in Chanel at the Series A stage and I had to sell it 5 years later, which would have been about 100 years ago, I would have missed out on a lot of upside that we've all seen, you know, from Chanel. So I think for us, it's a matter of premium, yes. And actually, some of my favorite brands are those that premiumize, commoditize,
yeah, sure,
you know, areas.
Yeah.
But kind of true luxury, no.
Yeah, yeah. So you're not going to invest in the next like leather shoe wear. Kind of whatever.
Right? Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah.
I would love to. And, you know, hopefully we have enough success at Five Seasons that I can do so
you
personally
can just do it.
Someday.
Yeah. Yeah. Got it. Okay. All right. Well, look, I mean, I wanted to move on. We could talk about that stuff for a long time because it is the stuff that I just geek out on a lot. But so I touched on this subject very briefly with Fred Dessen when I interviewed him. And that's the importance of both kind of entry valuation as an investor, as well as how you construct your portfolio downstream. Right. So I'd love to understand what your approach is when you're thinking about consumer ventures. And what do you think it's critical to ensure a balanced and successful portfolio? Well, like what is critical to ensure that it's balanced?
Yeah, so I think maybe first, just an important thing to cover on this is what's actually the end goal? You're running a venture fund. Yeah. What's the end goal? What does great returns look like? Mm. To be a top quartile, you know, venture fund, it means 3x return of the fund.
Yeah, and average, by the way, is about 1.8,
right,
which is, yeah. And as well invest in the S&P kind of thing.
Exactly. But by the way, even at 3x over a 10-year cycle,
yeah,
these days, yeah, if you hit the S&P right, you might be in a better shape. Not to talk myself out of raising the next fund, but so there's a bunch of different ways to get there. And I think when people think about venture, what they think about is, well, if you invest in 10 companies, one of them is going to do a 30x,
yeah,
and then the other 9 are going to be zeros, and you get to 3x,
yeah,
that way,
yeah,
or better than that. In consumer, and that's an appropriate point of view if you are a tech investor.
Sure.
And I think it's important to remember that basically venture capital was created in Silicon Valley for Silicon Valley, way before, you know, new consumer brands or D2C or any of that was even conceptualized. If you look at the history of venture-funded consumer brands, which is quite short, it's basically probably 2010 when Warby Parker started to now, there have been less than 10 $1 billion plus outcomes.
What would be the most famous?
Dollar Shave Club.
Dollar Shave Club, yeah.
Which was written down to zero within about 3 years. Yeah. I think the best exit, best in quotes, but it was Reformation, the fashion brand.
Don't even know them, yeah.
It was bought by Permira, London-based private equity firm, for $650 million and has, you know, was profitable at that time and has continued to be. But, less than 10. even less than 10, I think above 500 million.
And questionable kind of actual long-term success.
Exactly.
Right.
Whereas I happened to see this yesterday, so it's why it's top of mind. But in 2021, there were 96 tech exits above a billion alone. So we're playing a different game. Mm. And accordingly, what does that mean? Well, for me to get to my 3X, it's never going to be the 30X and the bunch of zeros.
You need a lot of those zeros to be doing something.
And so we underwrite our fund to, you know, we say 3 to 4X. We've been fortunate in that, you know, fund one is more or less there. We're investing out of fund two now, and we're really excited about the portfolio we have. When we think about portfolio construction, it's every deal individually. We need to be able to credibly underwrite it to between 3 and 5X. How do you kind of get there across a blend where, well, if you're underwriting things on the kind of higher end as 5, 6X, what it means is that you need to protect your downside risk significantly, which leads to entry valuation. So we really believe that 70-odd% of our work is done upfront on not only investing in, you know, great assets and amazing founders, but doing so at really defensible valuations, whereby if a business sells for $150 million, that needs to be a really good outcome for us.
Yeah.
If a business sells for $300 million, speaking in dollars, so let's say the Wild deodorant exit that was announced last week, which is about £230 million, $300 million, that needs to be a fantastic exit.
That needs to be like a 10X, 20X.
Exactly.
Which means you need to be coming in at like very sharp valuations. Like, but at Series A, like you're coming in, that means you have to come in at like 20 mil.
Yeah. And it's a mix, right? Again, that of course we'll view things on a case by case basis. And I think, you know, we've invested in earliest company we've ever invested in was doing about $250,000 a month at time of investment. So call it $3 million-ish run rate. We also invested in a business that was doing $8 million a month at time of investment. So our scope is broad. But when we think about portfolio construction, what we think about is each deal alone needs to look like a quote unquote five seasons deal. What does that look like? It's a credible kind of 3 to 5X.
Yeah. You're essentially, so you can't afford to take, I mean, you're not investing at pre-seed seed, right? And that's precisely the point, right? Because at pre-seed seed, you don't have enough. There is, irrespective of what you think about the founder, your thing about, however you think about the brand, there isn't enough data to support whether or not it is going to be one of those five season deals, right? Like, so you need to see where the business is to be able to come in an evaluation that makes sense for you to get to the outcomes that you're looking for. And I think it's really interesting, actually, this point, right? Because, you know, when I talk to founders, and of course, I you know, our client base tends to be far more tech heavy than consumer heavy, albeit that like we actually are starting to work with some really interesting consumer brands. And have some really interesting sort of consumer CFOs on our team. But, you know, when I talk to founders, it's like, you know, every business that a VC invests in, certainly within tech, needs to be able to be the billion-dollar outcome because of X, Y, Z. And that is because so many of them will go to zero, right? So you do need that massive outlier. But I guess what you're saying is the risk in consumer is that the likelihood of the outlier is much, much lower than it is in tech, right? And partly because, to your point, to your like earlier point, it's not about LTV, right? Like, so if you've got a SaaS business and you can confidently talk about, well, okay, you know, after 7 years of operating, we know that our lifetime value for a client is, you know, 5 years at X margin, like, okay, you've got predictability about, and you know what upside there is in the market, you've got predictability, you can figure out how those cash flows might look. With a consumer product, that's that much harder. Like, to your point, Dollar Shave Club went to zero. Like,
I mean, just even looking within our portfolio, so a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we sold Butternut Box dog food business to General Atlantic and L. Catterton.
Yeah.
For
both private equity firms.
Both private equity firms for about 500 million pounds. I think it still is to date the largest venture backed European consumer outcome.
Congrats.
Period.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do with it. It predated my time at the firm.
Like, but, it's all right. It's fine. Bask in the glory.
But on the one hand, it's like, sure, that's great. And an amazing job, you know, by my colleagues to find, invest, and help nurture that business. But on the other hand, it's like, well, okay, if that's like peak, like that's where we're talking about is peak. Okay, well then realistically, you know, half of that, as we said, 250 needs to be an awesome outcome. Mm. And more importantly, zeros, you know, cannot be. And I think if you were to talk to, you know, anyone at our firm, what they would say is, yeah, you know, Butternut Box was great. But actually the thing that we're proudest of is there's only one company that we've ever invested in that has gone to zero, because we put a lot of stress internally on ensuring that we're disciplined enough to not take punts because we can't really afford
to. You can't afford it. Yeah. Look, I mean, I think this is super interesting. I think I'm going to have to sit down with you separately and just get through a lot of this as well, because yeah, I mean, like it again, to my earlier point, it's very different from the tech. And I think this is exactly the point that I made at the start. Like the reason I don't get consumer in venture is because I hadn't really thought through a lot of these sort of complexities that you're talking about. Now that you've talked through them, I'm like, okay, now I understand. So actually consumer is much more like, you know, we had someone on the podcast, a couple of months ago, Hannah Maton, who's, you know, in Sweden, she was iZettle, which exited PayPal, and she's her fund now is a Nordic fund, very, very sort of tight software, but her Amply Ventures, her thesis or their thesis is like, we're not betting on power law here. Like, we want all of our portfolio companies to have good outcomes.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Like, what? Huh? Like, yeah. Like, absolutely mind-blowing, right? And I get it. Like, so I get why VC is the way it is, like the unicorn stuff. But I also, because I'm a CFO type person, I'm like, yeah, actually a portfolio of like, you know, five businesses that exited at 150 or 200 or whatever, one that exited at 80 and like one that maybe made it all the way to a billion, that's actually fine. Or actually 10 businesses that exit for, you know, between 100 and 500, like, yeah, you can make some decent money out of that. And it sounds to me like from a consumer perspective, that's exactly the sort of profile of portfolio you're talking about, which is not how, I guess, we've all been educated to think about venture in more general terms around power law and, you know, the long tail and outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm not even sure that venture capital is like the perfect nomenclature for
what you're doing in consumer.
Yeah. Right, for what people are doing in consumer.
Yeah. That actually makes a huge amount of sense. I'm like, I'm really glad we had this conversation. It's cleared up a lot of stuff for me. That was really helpful. But look, you and I, just switching tack, we've talked about this sort of idea of the value add VC, and you expressed, you know, not a little amount of skepticism about the concept, which will come as a shock to most VCs, but not most founders. But can you elaborate on what you believe makes a VC truly beneficial or detrimental even to a startup? And if there is no such thing as a truly value add VC, does that mean founders should stop optimizing for VC logos and just take cash from whoever it is and wherever they can get it, i.e. is all capital created equal?
Yeah, so I think the reason that I bristle a little bit at the term or idea around value add VC is that I think that sometimes people take it to mean that VCs make businesses win. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there's ever been a single outcome where the minority shareholder made the business win. Mm-hmm. Maybe they helped.
They may have helped on the on the exit or whatever, but they didn't help get to the exit.
But the founder, founders make or break a business, period, end of story. If I'm doing my job, maybe I can help them get places a little bit quicker. Maybe I can help them not make common mistakes because I have the benefit of seeing a portfolio of 20 companies that are trying to solve not the same problem, but
similar-ish.
I think that when you think about every investor type you could have, we can stack rank them. If you say dumb and disruptive, that's the worst investor you can have. Well, the second worst investor you can have is smart and disruptive, right? And then you have sort of silent investor and then additive investor. So the problem with that is that an investor can be smart and they still can be worse than a silent investor if they are smart and disruptive.
Yep.
And I think that's what founders really need to be uber conscious of when they're looking to raise capital and talk to as many people as possible. You know, we
How are they on the board? What kind of advice do they give? Do they like, do they help or do they hinder?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, most VCs, when they're courting businesses, certainly we do this and it's the right thing to do. We'll say, oh, you know, talk to the other founders in our portfolio, which is a great thing to do. But naturally, it's the founders in our portfolio. I would hope that they like or don't hate us. And if they do hate us, you know, I would hope that we would understand enough not to point you towards them. Talk to founders who are not in our portfolio. Talk to founders who, you know, we gave a term sheet to who said no and went with someone else.
And why.
And why. And just to get a feel for, you know, are we good people and are we going to be responsible, you know, stewards of equity in your company? Because it's your company, it's not ours. And I think that VC, because it has become such a sort of, for whatever reason, public interest.
I'd say Twitter is the reason, but
I think that's basically right. Every VC is constantly trying to differentiate themselves by saying, we had more value, we had more value, we had more value. And for me, it just all rings, you know, completely false. Hollow.
No, I think, so it's like, I think I would generally agree with you. I think there are some investors that can, that truly, well, so A, investors that understand when they should input and when they shouldn't input, right? I think that's the first thing. Like, when should you speak? When should you not speak? The second part is, when you do speak, are you speaking for the sake of speaking? Well, I mean, like, hopefully if you've understood when to speak, then you know that you should be speaking about something that you can actually opine about. But actually, like, for me, the way I think about the whole kind of investor ecosystem around venture, whether it's an accelerator, whether it's a VC, like, what do I really want, right? I want you to be able to connect me with the people that are going to drive my business forward. And what does that mean? So essentially what I'm looking for from a VC is network. So that means either other investors, if I need to raise a larger round. It means access to talent. So do you know either individuals within my space that I can attract into my business? Or do you know the sort of people that can hire those people in or recruit those people? And can you introduce me to logos that I'm trying to win, right? And then finally, can you introduce me or can you help, you know, smooth an exit pathway, which either means strategic acquirer, financial sponsor like private equity or whatever, or obviously IPO would be great. And obviously if you have IPO potential, then like you don't necessarily need an introduction for that, but like maybe they'll introduce you to the right investment bank or whatever. And I think it's the same with accelerators. I think the same with venture. It's actually the network that is more important than the advice. Like the advice is speak to these people and this is why, as opposed to you should do X, Y, or Z. And I think the other thing that I think is what has happened, and we'll talk about this in a second as well, is like, very clearly, this is probably more in the US than the UK, a lot of VCs, and there's two or three names that absolutely come to mind, like who have an opinion about everything, state their opinions as if they're facts, but have such a surface level understanding as to actually, you know, when you, if you are anyone who knows anything about the subject they're talking about, you're like, what the hell are you talking about? Right. And I think, you know, that has become problematic. And I think for founders, especially because, like, you know, when you're a founder, often it is the first time you're going out and doing something like this. It's like a tough journey. It's a really tough journey, very clearly. And you don't want to be spinning, like, you don't want to be chasing your tail and spinning plates. So you want direct and frank and correct direction. It doesn't need to be advice, whatever. And I'll give you a great example. So my previous guest, Maya, I was introduced to her by one of her team, and they asked if I go and meet Maya and the managing partner of ID4. And I said, yeah, fine. I didn't know why. I was like, okay, cool. I'll go meet. And I sat in a room with the two partners and one of their portfolio company founders. And basically I think I said this earlier, they pitched my business to him. I had no idea this was going to happen, but they were ex-founders, or at least the managing partner is an ex-founder. And he's like, dude, you need support on the finance side. You're like trying to do too much stuff at the moment. You've graduated from like angel investors to now some institutional capital. You need this support. And the founder was like, at the time, apparently he had like even questioned whether he should come to this meeting and like, I don't have time for this. It's not important. And as Maya walked out, she told me we've only been there 2 weeks. And he's like, I can't believe I didn't do this earlier. Yeah. And for me, like, obviously I'm very happy that, you know, that they introduced me and we made it happen through our business. But that to me is the right sort of investor, like where they're like, okay, here are the challenges you're going to face. You need support in this area. Here is an option. And like, I was happy to be an option. Let's put it that way. But we're not going to tell you to do this, but we're strongly advising that this is something you should consider. To me, that's the best kind of support investor that you can find.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you want out of your investor, so all of the network piece, which falls into helping me get there faster.
Yeah.
Right. Next is pattern recognition, which is making sure I don't make
the same mistakes,
which I think what you just mentioned would fall into.
Yeah.
And then the last piece, which you alluded to a moment ago, is just someone that you trust and like spending time with.
Yeah.
Because these aren't cursory relationships. Like, I've been investing in early stage consumer for almost 12 years now. I'm still in touch with almost every founder I've ever invested in.
That's incredible.
And I'm still in, you know, as an investor, a ton of investments from my prior firm. I mean, these are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year business relationships.
Yeah, we've talked about on the podcast before, average VC investment lasts longer than the average UK marriage.
Exactly, which is why, as well, when you're picking investors, spend time with them, you know, in person, which is more and more important now that, you know, not everyone does, in person, semi-socially, like, you know, in a conference room, but also maybe at a restaurant, like just get to know them.
Have a coffee, whatever. Yeah.
And ideally, you should have a relationship with your investor long before you start raising capital.
So I talked about this. So actually my pin thread on X is precisely that, right? Like I built relationships with angels and VCs before I knew I was ever going to build a business of any nature. My current business, I've not taken investment. That's a completely different, but it's not sort of the sort of business where you necessarily would or should, even though I probably could. But then when I started trying to build out the tech venture I was trying to build, which, you know, sadly didn't get as far as I would have hoped it would have, like, it was, I raised the cash in a month, like, that I needed to raise, right? And I think this is the thing that a lot of founders, you know, they get caught up in the sort of you know, VCs and we should, you know, we need to raise from venture and so on. And of course, that's fine. But I think people forget that the entire venture ecosystem is made up of human beings. Like, it is the biggest relationship game on the planet. That's all it is, right? And actually, you know, when people talk about gatekeeping, it's like, well, hold on a second, right? Like, I mean, okay, I know you because Joe Seeger Dupree introduced us. How do I know Joe? Well, okay, you know, I used to know Claire Cherry, who used to work with True Ventures, and I know Matt Truman a little bit. But like, almost every single kind of person I've had on this podcast has come either via me just reaching out and saying, hey, would you want to have a chat? Or someone introducing me and saying, I think it'd be really great if you had a chat. And it has never been easier, I think, to make those connections and to your point, build those relations early on, right? And it doesn't need to be, okay, you don't need to do it in the way I did it, like 6 years before you even have thought about building a business. But if you know that like in the next 6 months, I'm probably going to look out and I want to, you know, I'd love to have these guys on my cap table. Like it isn't hard now to get in front of them one way or the other, right? I know like founders think about this, well, I don't have time and I can't be, but like, let's face it, as a founder, you are going to spend 70% of your time fundraising irrespective. Like you're either thinking about it, doing it, or like deploying and figuring out how you approach your next round, right?
That's a fundamentally different thing about European founders than American founders. Yeah. And it's something that became quite stark to me as soon as I started, you know, investing full time here, which is American founders will meet with anyone who, I mean, I think anyone largely in general, but anyone attached to money in any way, they will take the meeting no matter what. Here, there is much more a feeling of I'm focused on my business. I'll meet with you when I need money, when I'm ready. And I think what, you know, my kind of message to those founders is that it's fine. I'll meet with you when you're ready. It's not a big deal. The person you're actually doing a disservice to is yourself.
Yeah.
Because then you're going to take 10 meetings with, you know, 8 different funds over the course of a week. You're going to kind of get on with 2 or 3 of them. You're going to meet them a second time, and 1 or 2 of them, if you're lucky, will make you an offer, and then you're going to make a decision. For the next 5, 6, 7 years, to have someone who you spent a total of 2 hours with, that just seems like a pretty crazy way to get married, you know, to me.
Yeah. I have seen that happen before. but no, look, I mean, I just on the American point, I think there's two things, right? I think Americans most, and you probably comment better than me, but from what I can tell, Americans are just more direct with business, right? So that which leads to the second point, which is they don't mind being transactional either. Whereas I think in Europe, we still have this mentality of, sorry, I'm like, I need to, like, would you mind investing in our, like, there isn't, we still have this sort of deference towards capital, or this, like, I don't know what the right word is. It's not fear. It's like almost shame that we need to be asking someone for money. And I'm sure a lot of founders will disagree with me. That's fine. I don't mind. But that's certainly by observation, that's the dynamic, right? And it is very much, and of course then they go on to, like, you know, onto various forums and complain about it. But whereas I think in the US, what you probably find, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong here, is founders, if they don't raise money from you, they're not going to be like, oh, well, screw you, you're awful, whatever. Like, they'll just move on to the next. I think in Europe, we get really hung up on the, well, why didn't they invest in our, why are all VCs so bad? And, you know, why did this one not invest in me, whereas this one might, or whatever? And it's just like, this is a reality. It's a relationship game, and it's chess, right? Like, to an extent, in the sense that, you know, if you're getting to the end of your fund, likelihood of you investing is lower, right? Because you're going to reserve those for either for follow on into your existing portfolio, or, you know, take one loss on like one that you really think is going to have, right? So your selection is going to be that much tighter. And I think a lot of this, what it actually boils down to, in my opinion, and my opinion only, I guess, is that I think if founders understood how VC worked a bit better, I think they would find that they would get to better outcomes as well. I think that like that's the sort of thing that I would say. But look, I mean, this has been a great conversation so far. We talked about this just now as well, but you know, it's been a long while since I would consider myself to have consumed news consistently, regularly, even. In the same way that most people do, right? I don't buy newspapers. I subscribe to the FT, but like I don't read it on a daily basis or whatever. And the way I think about it is I describe like I need to know what's happening, but I don't need to know what's actually going on, right? So I need to understand what the macro is, but like, do I care whether, I don't know, like I need to understand that Donald is doing what he's doing. Do I need to understand every single executive order that he's, you know, that he's signing? And apparently there's a few of those. But you made a decision to not consume media related to venture capital other than this podcast, I hope. Yes. But what was it that prompted you to do this or not do it, I guess, especially given that it seems that VCs are all over social media? And how do you think it's benefited you? And do you do anything else instead?
Yes, this originally actually came from my first job in venture working for Chris Burch because, and it wasn't because he was intentionally not consuming, you know, VC media, is because he was 65 years old and wasn't, you know, reading TechCrunch and was not thinking
made,
about
it. And had made his money, so like didn't need to.
Wasn't thinking about it. You know, at all. I'm not sure even today if I said to him, you know, what do you think of VC media? He'd say, you know, what is that?
Yeah. explain what you mean.
and I was obsessed with it, right? I had just gotten my first job in venture. I was very, you know, focused on it. I was in New York. There was a lot happening. And we saw kind of any buzzy D2C brand you can think of came into our office at some point. You know, from Warby to Bonobos to Bobble Bar to, you know, whatever. Mm. And Chris repeatedly just kept on passing. And it drove me insane. And I was 24 and I was like, I'm working for this old guy who knows nothing. He's ruining my life. And
hopefully you're watching, Christopher. This is a real story now.
And he just said, you know, look, we have a very simple business here. Like, we sell tchotchkes. That's what consumer is. So
if we sell what?
Tchotchkes.
Tchotchkes?
Yeah. It's,
you're going to have to explain that.
It's actually, I think it's probably a Yiddish word.
I was going to say,
it's very like New York. It just means like, you know, little.
Yeah, we sell baubles or whatever.
Yeah, baubles. Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay.
And it's a very simple game. So sell it for more than you paid for it and make money from that and buy more of them and do it again.
Yeah.
And so I don't understand what all these businesses are that are walking in here that have these massive EBITDA losses and they want me to fund them.
Yeah.
And it took me, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, enough years to see the cycle and realize that, oh, he was totally right.
Yeah.
And everything that had been telling me that he wasn't right was, you know, this VC's blog, that TechCrunch, you know, this person I followed on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And I started feeling like I really didn't have any points of view of my own.
Yeah.
And accordingly, I just said, okay, I'm going to go cold turkey on all of this. I'm going to unfavorite, you know, all of this stuff. And it's just an experiment. And the minute that I feel like, whoa, I missed something big because of my little temper tantrum, I'll go back to status quo. And that was like 10 years ago. Yeah. And I've still never gone back.
Yeah. I see it actually a lot, right? So I've noticed a shift in a number of people that I know here in the UK, especially, who've clearly been spending too much time either on LinkedIn or X, and actually predominantly X. And this is not a political statement. I'm not talking about kind of right, left wing or anything like that. But what I've seen is like they've become personas of, like, they've become surrogate personas of so many of the people that are very vocal on X, and you can probably figure out who some of those people are. And I'm starting to look at what they're saying and saying, but is that your opinion, or is that just the opinion that you now believe is your opinion, having now read it like 30 times, right? And I think some are worse than others. And I think, you know, one of the things that certainly helps is like writing long form stuff, like writing stuff down or doing a podcast like this, where you're actually having to think about ideas and talk about them in depth and challenge your own thinking a little bit, I think allows you much more nuance and perspective. I think the problem is with media is like, we all know that media, you know, so how do you sell media is by creating outrage of some nature, where it's like something clickbaitable. Like no one is writing about, you know, my dog licked my face and you've got a million views, right? Like, you are going to take the performatively contrarian position in order to get the kind of likes and clicks and so on that you want. And so I guess what I'm saying, and this is from someone who, like, I've been on LinkedIn a lot, although over the last probably 6 months, year, have really, really slowed down and stopped and thought about, like, okay, what is it that I what am I putting out into the world? Because one of the things that really depresses me is that, you know, you put useful, valuable content out into the world and you get nothing. You put a video of some rubbish and like put some VC meme on top, and all of a sudden you're like, you know, you go viral. And I think it just stunts our thinking. I really do. And I think I think, you know, detoxing from all of that. So I don't read TechCrunch. I always had a problem with TechCrunch, although I've had ex-TechCrunch journalists on here. Yeah. But the issue I had was like, it perpetuated this, like, you know, this idolization, I guess, of VC and VC like outcomes, which for the majority of people are not the outcomes they're going to see, right? Yeah. Like, is the other thing.
I mean, and I also think, I mean, LinkedIn is like a whole, LinkedIn might even be a bigger cesspool than Twitter
for other reasons
these days.
There's
this other issue, which is exactly what you just touched on there with TechCrunch and kind of creating this idolization. So much of VC media, like, I think some progress has been made for sure, but let's just call a spade, which is that VCs overwhelmingly are privileged people from privileged backgrounds that went to, you know, the same 25 schools and then did the same 5 jobs thereafter, right? Like, that, it just is what it is.
And apparently bought the same vest.
And yet all I see on LinkedIn is all of these people from super privileged backgrounds writing these long form posts telling me about all the adversity they overcame and what they learned from it. And like, there's nothing wrong with, there's nothing wrong with adversity. There's nothing wrong with coming from a privileged background. There's nothing wrong with feeling proud of, you know, accomplishments that you have made. But I don't need to read about it on LinkedIn. And I don't want every post that I read, when I'm trying to learn something, to instead be a, you know, scantily clad advertisement you or your firm or your company.
And you know what? Like, so, I mean, I know you've listened to the interview. Well, I think you've listened to the interview with Fred, but like, he's one of the few people to have ever said this out loud. He goes, I know that people are, like, when people are engaging with my posts, it's because they want money. Like, I know that.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know, I was looking at this, like, if you put investor, angel, anything like that on your profile, like, you're going to get more engagement.
Without question.
Because that's what's going to happen, right? And I think there are some people that mistake that engagement for adulation. They start buying, essentially they start drinking their own Kool-Aid, right? And I think, again, for me, and like, you know, I think because I've made a few angel investments, I crop up, but I'm very honest about the fact that I write 1,000-pound checks. Like, that's it, guys. Sorry.
Yep.
And B, very few of them because all my money's in my business. And C, like, if someone comes to me, and overtly sort of pitches me, as it were, I will tell them, look, I'm not investing. Sorry, that's just not what I do at the moment. But the minute you put that stuff out there, you're going to get that, right? And I think, and look, this is a social media question conversation in the sense that, like, what is, if that is what you're looking to do, that is what you're looking to do, and therefore fine. But equally, I think we, like those of us that do have platforms, I think have a responsibility to use them wisely, right? So one of the things that I try to do is make sure that when I post, I'm posting something that I think will be valuable or interesting, and it might be something that I've done recently. But equally, to your point about privilege, I think you can recognize privilege, right? You can say that I am privileged. You don't necessarily need to be like, sorry, I'm privileged.
Of course.
That is an accident of birth, right? Or whatever. But you can say, I come from privilege. I have had challenges, but like, this is what I've learned and this is what I've done in those circumstances. I think when it becomes either performative or sort of lecturing stroke paternal, like, you must do this because this is what I've done, that's the stuff I hate.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the stuff that I think actually confounds most founders and a lot of VCs, is like, they come onto these posts and they'll see a post from, I don't know, Harry Stebbings or something, and they'll be like, oh, okay, this is what I should do. And Harry may or may not be right in that instance, or I may not be right in that instance, or whatever, right? Like, because no business is the same, no investment is the same.
Yeah.
You know, yes, you can have some pattern recognition, but at the end of the day, if it were that simple, there'd be a hell of a lot more billion-dollar businesses out there, right? Like, and one word sort of slogans are not going to, or one sentence slogans are not going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right.
Okay, Sam, I think we're going to have to wrap up, which I'm really annoyed that we are going to have to do. But look, I've got one final question, which I ask all my guests, or have been doing recently. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction on from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, social, home? What is a hill that you would die on defending?
Ooh. Well, we covered VC media. I think that's very much one of them.
Yeah.
I guess I'll just say, and I certainly hope to be proven wrong in this respect, but, and I'm not even sure how contrarian this is, because I do think some people are saying it, but I think that the US that we grew up with is gone.
I think in the UK that's probably less contrarian than it is in the UK.
And I don't think it's coming back. I think that there's certainly amongst a particular group of people in the US, primarily those on the coast, primarily, those with backgrounds like mine, the feeling as well, there was some disruption, and then there was, order stability, restored, and, now there's disruption again. And I don't think that's what is going on. I think that
the disruption started and continued, essentially.
Yeah.
There was a hiatus.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think I have the same feeling, and I think that's happening throughout Western economies and democracies at the moment.
Fair point.
I'm sad. I will definitely say, like, I have family in, I have family in New York, in Phoenix, in Florida, and friends and sort of extended family in Florida and in Canada as well. And like, watching some of the stuff that's been said and done over the last couple of months, I'm like, really? Wow. Okay, fine. If we're going to go down that line, then I'm not entirely sure. And obviously, look, one thing is that there's been a wake up moment in Europe, which is definitely being seen. And obviously, I think the incoming German chancellor was very, very blunt a few days ago about, Europe can no longer rely on the US. I think that is a shame. I think we were stronger together. It's a bit like the Brexit conversation. I think, I would have said I would have preferred to remain in the EU. I think we were stronger together. But, things have evolved. But I think, your point that I sense very much sadness in when you say that, right? Like, so.
For sure. I mean, I think that, American exceptionalism, it's a real thing. As in, when I was growing up, no one ever said to me, oh, the US is the best. But it almost gets programmed into you.
Yeah, it's ingrained. It's the manifest destiny sort of thing.
Right. And you know, whether or not that was ever actually true, I'm sure there are plenty of people who would say it wasn't. And by the way, I might be one of them.
Sure.
But any inkling, any thinking, any, you know, facade that might have ever been true, I think has just been obliterated.
Yeah. And just before we wrap up, I mean, do you think the US population is cognizant of that at large?
I think that, so at large, no, because this administration won majority of popular vote, so it wasn't just an electoral college issue.
Marginal but still. Yeah.
And then I think for, you know, maybe the folks who, you know, didn't vote for this current administration, there is a somewhere between tacit realization, which is, you know, this might be the case, but it doesn't affect me on a day-to-day, so or just a, you know, maybe more conscious decision of, yes, this is happening, but, you know, look at what, one, this is my home, or two, look at what living here, you know, look at, you know, the economic opportunities that exist, or the this or the that. But no, I don't think there's like a, I don't think there's a collective.
There's not an uprising of feeling that this is, yeah.
Yeah.
I do think what we're going to see is much more US to Europe migration.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. And especially because, you know, for Americans, the trip isn't a big deal.
And it's cheaper out here.
It's much cheaper here. And, you know, for me, like my family lives on the West Coast now. Mm. New York to the West Coast and New York to London, the flight's the same. So it's not a, like, it doesn't make a material difference to me. And I think a lot of people who grew up in the US likely went to uni far away, have, you know, kind of lived far away from their families. There's less of the maybe
the roots that are keeping them there.
Exactly.
Yeah. We shall see. Sam, this has been I'm like so glad we did this. Thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely amazing. For our listeners and our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? You're on Twitter? Where's the best place to find on the internet, given everything we've just said?
Yeah, so I am on LinkedIn. And that's about it.
Okay.
But the best way to get me, honestly, is over email, and it's sam@fiveseasons.vc.
Okay, amazing. Well, we're going to put some of the contacts in the show notes. But look, for the time being, thank you so much for being here. It's been absolutely incredible.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.